head for days. There is always a way out of a situation. Might be ugly, might leave you feeling like the earth has gone and shifted under your feet, but there is always a way around.
I'm going to ride up there, said Alice. I can't see what we have to lose.
Your head, said Sophia.
Right now, the way my head is, it wouldn't make that much difference.
You know the stories come out of that family, and you know how much they hate us right now. You just fixin' to get yourself killed.
You want to tell me what other chance Marjorie has right now? Alice said.
Sophia gave Alice a hard look, but didn't answer.
Right. Does anyone have the map for that route?
For a moment, Sophia didn't move. Then she opened the drawer wordlessly and flicked through the assembled papers until she found it and handed it over.
Thank you, Sophia.
I'm coming with you, said Beth.
Then I'm coming too, said Izzy.
Kathleen reached for her hat.
Looks like we got us an outing.
Here, 8 tomorrow?
Let's make it 7, said Beth.
For the first time in days, Alice found she was smiling.
Lord help the lot of you, said Sophia, shaking her head.
Chapter 25. It was clear within a couple of hours of setting out why only Marjorie and Charlie ever undertook the route to Arnott's Ridge. Even in the benign conditions of early September, the route was remote and arduous, taking in steep crevasses, narrow ledges, and a variety of obstacles to scrabble down or over, from ditches to fences to fallen trees. Alice had brought Charlie, confident he would understand where he was going, and so it proved. He strode out willingly, his huge ears flicking backward and forward, following his own well-worn tracks along the creek bed and up the side of the ridge, the horses following on behind. There were no notches on trees here, no red ribbons. Marjorie had plainly never expected anyone but herself to take such a route, and Alice glanced behind her intermittently at the other women, hoping she could trust Charlie as a guide. Around them, the air hung thick and moist, and the newly amber forests lay dense with fallen leaves, muffling sound as they made their way along the hidden trails. They rode in silence, focused on the unfamiliar terrain, only breaking off to praise their horses quietly or warn of some approaching obstacle. It occurred to Alice as they headed along the track into the upper reaches of the mountains that they had never ridden together, not all of them, like this. And then that it was entirely possible this would be the last time she rode into the mountains. In a week or so, she would be making her way by train toward New York and the huge ocean liner that would take her to England, and a very different kind of existence. She turned in her saddle and looked at the group of women behind her and realized she loved them all, that leaving each of them, not just Fred, would be a wrench almost greater than anything she had endured up to now. She couldn't imagine meeting women with whom she would feel so in tune, so close to in her next life, over polite chit-chat and cups of tea. The other librarians would slowly forget her, their lives busy with work and families and the ever-changing challenges of the seasons. Oh, they would promise to write, of course, but it wouldn't be the same. There would be no more shared experiences, the cold wind on their faces, the warnings of snakes on tracks, or commiserations when one of them took a fall. She would gradually become a postscript to a story.
Do you remember that English girl who rode with us for a while? Bennett Van Cleve's wife?
Think we're getting close?
Kathleen broke into her thoughts, riding up alongside. Alice pulled Charlie to a halt, unfolding the map from her pocket.
According to this, it's not far over that ridge, she said, squinting at the hand-drawn images. She said the sisters live 4 miles that way, and Nancy would always walk the last part because of the hanging bridge, so I make the McCullough house somewhere over there.
Beth scoffed.
You reading that map upside down? I know for a fact the damn bridge is that way.
Alice's belly was tight with nerves. If you know better, you want to head off on your own and let us know when you're there?
No need to get ornery. You're not from here is all. I just thought I...
Oh, and don't I know it? Like the whole town hasn't spent the last year reminding me.
No need to take it like that, Alice. Shoot, I just meant some of us might have more knowledge of the mountains than...
Shut up, Beth.
Even Izzy was irritated.
We wouldn't even have got this far if it wasn't for Alice.
Hold up, said Kathleen. Look. It was the smoke that alerted them, a thin, apologetic whisper of gray that they might not have spotted had the trees nearby not lost their leaves from the crown, so that the wavering plume was briefly visible against the leaden sky. The women stopped in the clearing, just able to make out the shack squatting on the ridge, its shingle roof missing a couple of tiles, its yard unkempt. It was the only house for miles, and everything about it spoke of neglect and an antipathy toward casual visitors. A mean-looking dog, tethered to a chain, set up a fierce staccato bark, already aware of their presence through the trees.
Think they'll shoot at us?
Said Beth, and spat noisily. Fred had instructed Alice to bring his gun, and it was slung over her shoulder by its strap. She couldn't work out whether it was a good or a bad thing for the McCullough family to see she had it in her possession.
Wonder how many of them are in there. Someone told my eldest brother that none of the out-of-town McCulloughs even came up this far.
Yeah, like Mrs. Brady said, they most likely just came for the circus,
said Kathleen, squinting as she tried to see better.
Ain't like they were coming for the McCullough riches, is it? What did your mama say about you coming up here anyway?
Said Beth to Izzy.
I'm surprised she let you.
Izzy pushed Patch forward over a small ditch, clearing it with a grunt.
Izzy?
She doesn't exactly know.
Izzy? Alice turned in her saddle.
Oh, hush, Alice. You know as well as I do that she would never have let me.
Izzy rubbed at her boot. They all faced the house. Alice shivered.
If anything happens to you, your mother is going to have me in that dock alongside Marjorie. Oh, Izzy, this is not safe. I would never have let you come had you told me.
Alice shook her head.
So why did you come, Izzy?
Said Beth.
Because we are a team, and a team sticks together.
Izzy lifted her chin.
We are the Baileyville Pack Horse Librarians, and we stick together.
Beth punched her lightly on the arm as her horse moved forward.
Well, goddamn to that.
Will you ever stop cursing, Beth Pinker?
And Izzy punched her back and squealed as the horses collided. In the end, it was Alice who went first. They walked up as far as the snarling dog on the chain would allow, and Alice dismounted, handing her reins to Kathleen. She took a few steps toward the door, staying wide of the dog, its teeth bared and its hackles lifted in little spikes. She eyed the chain nervously, hoping that the other end was pinned securely.
Hello?
Two windows at the front, thick with dirt, stared back blankly at them. If it hadn't been for the trickle of smoke, she might have been certain that nobody was home. Alice took a step closer, her voice lifting.
Miss McCullough? You don't know me, but I work at the Pack Horse Library down in town. I know you didn't want to talk to the sheriff's men, but I would very much appreciate it if you could help us at all.
Her voice bounced off the mountainside. There was no movement from within the house. Alice turned and looked at the others uncertainly. The horses stamped their feet impatiently, their nostrils flaring as they eyed the growling dog.
It would really only take a minute.
The dog turned its head and quieted briefly. For a moment, the mountain was possessed of a dead silence. Nothing stirred, not the horses, the birds in the trees. Alice felt her skin prickle, as if this presaged something terrible. She thought of the description of McCullough's body, his eyes pecked clean out of his head, lying not too far from here for months. I don't want to be here, she thought, and felt something visceral and fearful trickle down her spine. She looked up and saw Beth, who nodded at her, as if to say, go on, try again.
Hello? Miss McCullough? Anybody?
Nothing stirred.
Hello?
A voice broke into the silence.
Y'all can get and leave us alone!
Alice turned on her heel to find two barrels of a gun visible through the gap in the door. She swallowed and was about to speak again when Kathleen appeared on foot beside her. She put a hand on Alice's arm.
Verna, is that you? I don't know if you remember me, but it's Kathleen Hannigan, now Bly. I used to play with your sister down at Split Creek. We made corn dollies with my ma one harvest time, and I think she made one for you, with a spotted ribbon. Would you remember that?
The dog was eyeing Kathleen now, its lips pulled back over its teeth.
We're not here to cause no trouble, she said, her palms up. We're just in something of a fix with our good friend, and we'd be real grateful for the chance to speak with you for a moment or two about it.
We got nothing to say to any of yous.
Nobody moved. The dog stopped growling briefly, its nose pointing toward the door. The two barrels didn't budge.
I ain't coming to town, said the voice from inside. I'm not coming. I told the sheriff what day our pa disappeared, and that's that. You ain't getting nothing else.
Kathleen took a step closer.
We understand, Verna. We would just really welcome a couple minutes of your time to talk. Just to help our friend. Please?
There was a long silence.
What happened to her?
They looked at each other.
You don't know? Said Kathleen.
Sheriff just said they found my pa's body, and the murderer to go with it.
Alice spoke up.
That's pretty much it. Except, Miss Verna, it's our friend who is standing trial, and we would swear on the Bible that she is not a murderer.
Miss Verna, you may know of Marjorie O'Hare. You know her daddy's name travels before her.
Kathleen's voice had lowered, as if they were in some casual conversation.
But she's a good woman, a little unconventional, but not a cold-blooded killer. And her baby faces growing up without a mother because of gossip and rumor.
Marjorie O'Hare had a baby?
The gun lowered an inch.
Who'd she marry?
They exchanged awkward glances.
Well, she ain't exactly married.
But that doesn't mean nothing,
Izzy called hurriedly.
Doesn't mean she isn't a good person.
Beth brought her horse a few steps closer toward the house and held up a saddlebag.
You want some books, Miss McCullough? For you or your sister? We got recipe books, story books, all kinds of books. Lots of families up in the mountains happy to take them. You don't have to pay, and we'll bring you new ones when you like.
Kathleen shook her head at Beth and mouthed, I don't think she can read. Alice, anxious, tried to talk over them.
Miss McCullough, we're truly, truly sorry about your father. You must have loved him very much, and we're really sorry to trouble you with this matter. We wouldn't be here unless we were desperate to help our friend.
I ain't sorry,
the girl said. Alice swallowed the rest of her sentence. Her shoulders slumped a little. Beth's mouth closed in dismay.
Well, I appreciate it's natural you would harbor ill feelings toward Marjorie, but I would beg you just to hear,
not her.
Verna's voice hardened.
I ain't sorry about what happened to my pa.
The women looked at each other, confused. The gun lowered slowly another inch, and then disappeared.
You the Kathleen used to have braids pinned upside your head?
That's me.
You rode all the way up here from Baileyville?
Yes, ma'am, said Kathleen.
There was a brief pause.
Then you'd best come in.
As the librarians watched, the rough wooden door slid open a fraction and then, after a moment, opened a little wider, creaking on its hinges. And there, for the first time in the gloom, they saw the 20-year-old figure of Verna McCullough, dressed in a faded blue dress with patches on the pockets and a headscarf knotted over her hair. her sister moving in the shadows behind her. There was a short silence while they all took in what was in front of them.
"Well, shit," said Izzy under her breath.
Chapter 26. Alice was first in the queue for the courthouse on Monday morning. She had barely slept, and her eyes were sore and gritty. She had brought fresh baked cornbread to the jail earlier in the morning, but Officer Dulles glanced down at the tin and observed, apologetically, that Marjorie wasn't eating.
"Barely touched a thing over the weekend."
He looked genuinely concerned.
"You take it anyway, just in case you can get her to eat something later."
"You didn't come yesterday."
"I was busy."
He frowned at the abruptness of her answer, but plainly decided that things were off-kilter enough in the town that week without him questioning it further, and headed back down to his cells. Alice took her place at the front of the public gallery and regarded the crowd. No Kathleen, no Fred. Izzy slid in beside her, then Beth, smoking the tail end of a cigarette that she stubbed out under her feet.
"Heard anything?"
"Not yet," said Alice.
And then she startled. There, two rows back, sat Sven, his face somber and his eyes shadowed as if he hadn't slept for weeks. He kept his eyes to the front and his hands on his knees. There was something in the rigidity of his bearing that suggested a man working hard to keep himself contained, and the sight of him made her swallow painfully. She flinched as Izzy's hand reached across and squeezed her own, and she returned the pressure, trying to keep her breath steady in her chest. A minute later, Marjorie was led in, her head down and her gait slow. She stood, her expression unreadable, no longer even bothering to meet anybody else's eye.
"Come on, Marge," she heard Beth mutter beside her.
And then Judge Arthurs entered the courtroom, and everybody rose.
"Miss Marjorie O'Hare here is a victim of unhappy circumstance. She was, if you like, in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, only God will ever know the truth of what happened on the top of that mountain, but we do know that it is only the flimsiest of evidence that takes a library book, one which by all accounts may have traveled halfway across Lee County, and places it near a body that may have come to rest some 6 months earlier."
The defense counsel looked up as the doors at the back opened and everyone swiveled in their seats to see Kathleen Bly march in, sweaty and a little breathless.
"Excuse me. I'm very sorry. Excuse me."
She ran to the front of the court, where she stooped to speak to Mr. Turner. He glanced behind him and then stood, one hand on his tie, as the people in the court murmured their surprise.
"Your Honor, we have a witness who would very much like to say something before the court. Can it wait? Your Honor, this has a material bearing on the case."
The judge sighed.
"Approach the bench, please, counsels."
The two men stood at the front. Neither attempted to lower their voices much, one from urgency and the other from frustration, so the court got to hear pretty much everything that was said.
"It's the daughter," said Mr. Turner. "What daughter?" said the judge. "McCullough's daughter, Verna."
The prosecution counsel glanced behind him and shook his head.
"Your Honor, we have had no prior notice of such a witness, and I object in the strongest terms to the introduction of such at so late—"
The judge chewed ruminatively.
"Did the sheriff's men not go up to Arnott's Ridge to try to talk to the girl?"
The prosecution counsel stammered,
"Well, yes, but she wouldn't come down. She hasn't left that house in several years, according to those familiar with the family."
The judge leaned back in his chair.
"Then I would say, if this is the victim's daughter, possibly the last witness to see him alive, and she is now content to make her way down into the town to answer questions about his last day, then she may well have information pertinent to the case. Wouldn't you agree, Mr. Howard?"
The prosecution counsel glanced behind him again. Van Cleve was straining forward in his seat, his mouth compressed with displeasure.
Yes, Your Honor.
Good. I will hear the witness.
He waved a finger. Kathleen and the lawyer spoke for a minute in hushed voices, and then she ran to the back of the court.
When you're ready, Mr. Turner.
Your Honor, the defense calls Miss Verna McCullough, daughter of Clem McCullough. Miss McCullough, if you could make your way to the witness box, I would be much obliged.
There was a hum of interest. People strained in their seats. The door opened at the back of the court, revealing Kathleen, her arm through that of a younger woman, who walked a little behind her. And as the court watched in silence, Verna McCullough made her way slowly and deliberately to the front of the courtroom, every stride an apparent effort. Her hand rested on the small of her back, and her belly sat low and huge in front of her. A murmur of shock and a second wave of exclamation as the same thought occurred to each person went up around the room.
You live at Arnott's Ridge?
Verna had held her hair back with a bobby pin and now fiddled with it as if it were out of place. Her voice emerged as a hoarse whisper.
Yes, sir, with my sister. And before that, our father.
Can you speak up, please?
Said the judge. The lawyer continued.
And it's just the three of you?
She held on to the lip of the witness box and gazed around her, as if she had only just noticed how many people were in the room. Her voice faltered for a moment.
Miss McCullough?
Yes. Our mama went when I was 8, and it's been us three since then.
Your mama died?
I don't know, sir. We woke up one morning, and my daddy said she was gone, and that was it.
I see. So you are unsure as to her fate?
Oh, I believe her to be dead, because she always said my daddy would kill her one day.
Objection, said the state prosecutor.
Strike that from the record, please. We will leave it on file that Miss McCullough's mother's whereabouts are unknown. Thank you, Miss McCullough. And when did you last see your father?
That would be 5 days before Christmas.
And have you seen him since?
No, sir.
Did you look for him?
No, sir.
You weren't troubled when he didn't come home for Christmas?
It was not unusual behavior for our daddy. I think it may be no secret that he liked a drink. I believe he was known to the sheriff.
The sheriff nodded, almost reluctantly.
Sir, would it be possible for me to sit down? I'm feeling a little faint.
The judge motioned to the clerk to bring her a chair, and the court waited while it was positioned, and she was able to sit. Someone brought her a glass of water. Her face was only just visible above the witness box, and most in the public gallery leaned forward to try to see her better.
So when he didn't come home on the 20th of December, Miss McCullough, you didn't see anything particularly untoward in that behavior?
No, sir.
And when he left, did he tell you where he was going? To a bar?
For the first time, Verna hesitated a good while before she spoke. She glanced at Marjorie, who was looking at the floor.
No, sir. He said...
She swallowed and then turned toward the judge.
He said he was going to return his library book.
There was an outburst from the public gallery, a sound that might have been shock or a burst of laughter or a mixture of both. It was hard to tell. Marjorie, in the dock, lifted her head for the first time. Alice looked down to find that Izzy was gripping her hand, her knuckles white. The defense lawyer turned to face the jury.
Can I check that I heard that correctly, Miss McCullough? You said your father set out to return a library book?
Yes, sir. He had recently been receiving books from the WPA Pack Horse Library, and he believed it was a great thing. He had just read a fine book and said it was his civic duty to return it as soon as possible so that some other person could have the benefit of reading it.
The heads of Mr. Howard, the state prosecutor, and his second were pressed together in urgent conversation. He raised his hand, but the judge dismissed him with a wave.
Go on, Miss McCullough.
Me and my sister, well, we did warn him in the strongest terms not to set out because the conditions were bad, what with the snow and ice and all, and that he might slip and fall, but he had taken a fair bit to drink and he would not be told. He was insistent that he didn't want to be late back with his library book.
Her gaze flickered around the courtroom as she spoke, her voice now level and certain.
So Mr. McCullough set out by himself on foot into the snow?
He did, sir, taking the library book.
To walk to Baileyville?
Yes, sir. We warned him it was a foolish enterprise.
And you never saw or heard from him again?
No, sir.
And you didn't think to look for him?
Me and my sister, we don't leave our home, sir. After our mama went, our daddy never liked for us to come to town, and we didn't like to disobey him, what with his temper and all. We went around the yard before nightfall and shouted for him, just in case he had taken a fall. But most times he would just come back when it pleased him.
So you just waited for him to return?
Yes, sir. He had threatened to leave us before now, so I guess when he didn't return, some part of us thought maybe he had finally done so. And then back in April, the sheriff came up to tell us he was dead.
And, Miss McCullough, may I ask one more question? You have been most courageous making this trip down the mountain and completing this difficult testimony, and I am much obliged to you. One final question. Do you remember what book it was that your father enjoyed so much and felt such an obligation to return?
Why, yes, I do, sir. Most clearly.
And here, Verna McCullough turned her pale blue eyes on those of Marjorie O'Hare, and to those nearest, it was possible that the faintest smile played around her lips.
It was a book by the name of Little Women.
The court exploded into a wall of noise, so that the judge was forced to bang his gavel 6-8 times before enough people noticed, or could hear enough, to quiet it. There was laughter, disbelief, and shouted fury from different parts of the court, and the judge, his brows an overhanging ledge, grew puce with anger.
Silence! I will not have this court held in disrespect, do you hear me? The next person to make a sound will be in contempt of court. Silence in the court!
The room quieted. The judge waited a moment to be sure that everyone had got the message.
Now, counsels, will you approach the bench?
There was some muttered conversation, this time inaudible in the court, under which a low hum of whispers had begun to escalate dangerously. Across the courtroom, Mr. Van Cleve looked like he was about to combust. Alice saw him get up once, twice, but the sheriff turned and physically forced him to sit down. She could see Van Cleve pointing, his mouth working, as if he couldn't believe he too didn't have the right to go up and debate with the judge. Marjorie sat very still, disbelieving.
"Go on,"
muttered Beth, her knuckles white where she gripped the bench.
"Go on, go on."
And then, after an age, the two lawyers made their way back to their seats, and the judge banged his gavel again.
"Can we call the physician back, please?"
There was a low murmur as the physician was recalled to the witness box. The public gallery was full of people shifting in their seats, pulling faces at each other. The defense counsel rose.
"Dr. Tasker, one further question. In your professional opinion, would it be possible that the bruising to the victim's face might have been caused by the weight of a large, hard-backed book falling onto it? For example, if he had slipped and fallen backward."
He motioned to the clerk and held up the copy of Little Women.
"One the size of this edition, for example. Here, I'll let you feel the weight of it."
The physician weighed the book in his hands and considered this for a moment.
"Why, yes, I would imagine that would be a reasonable explanation."
"No further questions, Your Honor."
It took the judge 2 more minutes of legal conversation to conclude. He banged his gavel to quiet the court. Then, abruptly, he rested his head in his hands and stayed like that for a full minute. When he raised it, he eyed the court with what seemed to be an impossibly weary expression.
"It seems to me, in the light of this new evidence, I am minded to agree with the defense counsel that this can no longer be positioned with any certainty as a murder trial. All solid evidence seems to suggest this was an unfortunate accident. A good man set out to do a good deed, and due to the, prevailing conditions, shall we say, suffered an untimely end."
He took a deep breath and placed his hands together.
"Given the Commonwealth evidence in this case is largely circumstantial and heavily dependent on this one book, and given the witnesses' clear and unwavering testimony as to its prior whereabouts, I am moved to strike this trial and instead record a verdict of accidental death. Miss McCullough, I thank you for your efforts in doing your civic duty, and I wish to convey my public and heartfelt condolences once again for your loss. Miss O'Hare, you are hereby free to leave the court. Clerks, if you could release the prisoner."
This time, the court did erupt. Alice found herself suddenly enveloped by the other women, who were jumping up and down, yelling, tears streaming from their eyes, arms and elbows and chests pressed together in a giant hug. Sven vaulted over the barrier of the public gallery and was there as the jailer undid Marjorie's handcuffs, his arms closing around Marjorie just as she began to sink to the floor in shock. He half-walked, half-carried her swiftly out of the back exit, Deputy Dulles shielding them before anyone could really work out what was happening. Through it all, Van Cleve could be heard yelling that this was a travesty, an absolute travesty of justice. And those with particularly good hearing could just make out Mrs. Brady retorting,
"Shut your fat mouth for once in your life, you old goat!"
In all the hubbub, nobody noticed Sophia quietly leave the colored section of the public gallery, her bag tucked neatly under her arm, disappearing through the door and briskly making the short walk to the library, picking up speed as she went. And only those with the very keenest hearing would have heard Verna McCullough as she was steered out past the librarians, her hand still on the small of her back and her face grimly determined, as she muttered under her breath, "Good riddance." Nobody felt Marjorie should be left alone, so they brought her to the library and locked both doors, mindful that Kentucky's most widely circulated newspapers, as well as half of the town, suddenly wanted to talk to her. She said barely a word during the short walk there, her movements slow and oddly frail, as if she had been ill, though she did eat half a bowl of bean soup that Fred brought down from the house, her eyes fixed on it as she ate, as if it were the only thing of any certainty around her. The women exclaimed among themselves about the shock of the verdict, Van Cleve's impotent fury, the fact that young Verna had indeed done as she had promised. She had spent the previous night at Kathleen's cabin, having been walked down on Patch, and even then she had been so nervous at the prospect of facing all those townspeople that Kathleen had been afraid she would find her gone when she awoke. It was only when Fred arrived in the morning with his truck to bring them to court that Kathleen believed they might be in with a chance, and even then the girl was so odd and unpredictable that they had no idea what she was going to say. Marjorie listened to all this as if from a distance, her expression oddly blank and distracted, as if she found the noise and commotion too much after the months of near silence. Alice wanted to hug her, and yet something about Marjorie's demeanor forbade it. None of them knew what to say to her, and found themselves talking as if to a near stranger. Did she want some more water? Was there anything they could get for her? Really, Marjorie should only say. And then,
Almost an hour after they arrived, there was a short rap at the door, and Fred, hearing a familiar low voice, moved to unlock it. He opened it a fraction, then his eyes fixed on something unseen, and his smile widened. He stepped back, and up the two short steps walked Sven, holding the baby, who was wearing a pale yellow dress and bloomers, her eyes button bright and her hands gripping his sleeve tightly in her tiny fist. Marjorie's head lifted, and her hands moved slowly to her mouth as she saw her. Her eyes filled with tears, and she rose slowly to her feet.
"Virginia?"
she said, her voice cracking as if she could barely trust what she was seeing. Sven moved to her and handed the baby to her mother, and Marjorie and the child gazed into each other's eyes, the child scanning her mother's as if to reassure herself of something. And then, as they watched, the tiny girl took a moment, then let her head come to rest in the space under her mother's chin, her thumb plugged into her mouth, and as she did, Marjorie closed her eyes and began to sob, silently, her chest heaving violently as if some terrible pain was exercising itself, her face contorted. Sven stepped forward and placed his arms around the two of them, holding them close to him, his head lowered, and mindful that they were now privy to something that felt beyond the realms of what was decent, Fred and the librarians tiptoed out of the library and made their way silently up the path to Fred's house. The Baileyville WPA Pack Horse librarians were a team, yes, and a team stuck together. But there were some times when it was only right to be alone. It would be several days before the other librarians noticed the ledger the sheriff had believed missing, disappeared in the great floods, stacked neatly with the others in the shelf to the left of the door. Under the date of December 15, 1937, it showed a loan to Mr. C. McCullough, Arnott's Ridge, of one hardback edition of Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, one page ripped, back cover slightly damaged. Only someone who looked terribly hard might have noticed how the entry sat between two lines, its ink a very faintly different shade from those around it, and only if you were very cynical indeed might you wonder why there was a one-word entry beside it, written in that same ink. Unreturned. Chapter 27. Up in this high air, you breathed easily, drawing in a vital assurance and lightness of heart. In the highlands, you woke up in the morning and thought, "Here I am, where I ought to be." Karen Blixen, Out of Africa. Much to the disappointment of the traders and bartenders, it took less than a day for Baileyville to empty. After the "not guilty" shock verdict headlines had been reduced to firelighters and draft proofing, and the last of the mobile homes had rattled their way back across county lines, and the prosecution lawyer with the three inexplicably slashed tires had managed to get a spare set sent over from Lexington, Baileyville swiftly returned to normal, leaving nothing but muddy tracks and empty food wrappers dotted along the verges to show that a trial had ever taken place. Kathleen, Beth, and Izzy escorted Verna back to her cabin, taking turns to walk while Verna rode the sturdy Patch. The journey took the best part of a day, and they parted with promises that Nita, Verna's sister, would come and find them if she needed help with her laboring. Nobody ever spoke of the paternity of the child, and Verna had once again grown silent by the time they reached the door, as if exhausted by all the unfamiliar contact. They did not expect to hear from her again. That first night, Marjorie O'Hare lay in her own bed, facing Sven Gustafsson in the near dark. Her hair was soft and clean from her bath, and her belly was full, and out of the open window she could hear the owls and the crickets calling into the darkness of the mountainside, a sound that made the blood slow in her veins and her heart beat with an easy rhythm. They watched the tiny girl who lay between them, her arms thrown back in sleep, her mouth making soft shapes as she dreamed. Sven's hand rested on the swell of Marjorie's hip, and Marjorie relished the weight of it, the prospect of the nights to come.
"We can still leave, you know," he said quietly.
She lifted the child's cotton blanket, tucking it under her chin.
"Leave where?" "Here. I mean, what you said about your mother's warning and getting a fresh start. I've been reading up on places in Northern California where they're seeking farmers and homesteaders. Think you'd like it up there. We could make a good life."
When she said nothing, he added,
"Doesn't have to be in a city. It's a big old state. People go to California from all over, so nobody looks twice at someone from elsewhere. I got a friend with a cantaloupe farm, says he'll give me work while we find our feet."
Marjorie pushed her hair back from her face.
"I don't think so." "Well, we could look at Montana, if you prefer the sound of it." "Sven, I want to stay. Here."
Sven propped himself up on his elbow. He studied her expression as best he could in the dim light.
"You said you wanted Virginie to have freedom, to live however she wanted."
"I know I did," said Marjorie, "and I do. But it turns out we have real friends here, Sven, people who have our backs. I've thought about it, and as long as she's got those, she'll be okay. We'll be okay."
When he didn't speak, she added,
"Would that be agreeable to you, if we just stayed?" "Any place that has you in Virginia is agreeable to me."
There was a long silence.
"I love you, Sven Gustafsson," she said.
He turned toward her in the dark.
"You're not getting sentimental on me, are you, Marge?"
"Didn't say I was going to say it twice."
He smiled and lay back against the bolster. After a moment, he reached his hand across, and she took it and held it tight in her own. And that was how they slept, for a couple of hours at least, until the baby woke again. It had been shocking to Alice how quickly her feelings of delight and elation at Marjorie's return home had turned to cold stone as she grasped that this meant there was no longer a single obstacle left to her own immediate departure. That was it. The trial was over, and so was her time in Kentucky. She had stood among the librarians and watched Sven drive Marjorie and Virginia up the road toward the old cabin, and felt herself begin to calcify by inches as she realized what it meant. She managed to maintain her smile as they all drifted away, exclaiming to each other, hugging and kissing, had promised she might see them at the Nice and Quick later for a celebration. But the effort was too great, and even as Beth kicked her cigarette butt into the road and gave a cheery wave, she could feel something hard settling in her chest. Only Fred caught it, something in his expression mirroring her own.
"Would you care for a bourbon?" said Fred, as they locked the library door and walked slowly up to his house.
Alice nodded. She had just a matter of hours left in the town. He poured two tumblers and handed her one, and she sat down on his good settle with the buttoned cushions and the patchwork quilt over the back, the one his mother had made. It had grown dark outside, and the balmy weather had given way to a brisk wind and fine, spitting rain, and Alice was already dreading heading out in it again. Fred reheated the rest of the soup, but she had no appetite, and, she realized, nothing to say. Alice tried not to look at his hands, both of them conscious of the clock ticking on the mantle and what it meant. They talked of the trial, but even though they painted it in bright colors, Alice knew that Van Cleve would be even more furious now, would no doubt redouble his efforts to ruin the library or make sure her life was as uncomfortable as it could be. Besides, no matter what Marjorie had said, she couldn't stay in the cabin any longer. They all knew that Sven and Marjorie would need time alone, and it was telling that when she told them she had been invited to stay at Izzy's that evening, their protests had been half-hearted.
"So what time is your train?"
said Fred.
10:15.
You want me to drive you to the station?
That would be kind, Fred, if it's no trouble.
He nodded awkwardly and tried to raise a smile, which slid away as quickly as it arrived. She felt the same residual pain she always did at his discomfort, knowing that she was the cause of it. What right had she to make any claim on this man anyway, knowing it was impossible? She had been selfish to allow his feelings to come anywhere near her own. Sunk in misery that neither of them felt able to articulate, their conversation had swiftly become strained. Alice, sipping a drink she could barely taste, wondered briefly if it had been a good idea coming here at all. Perhaps she should have gone straight to Izzy's. What was the point in prolonging all this heartbreak?
Oh, got another letter this morning at the library. In all the commotion, I forgot to give it to you.
Fred pulled the envelope from his pocket and handed it to her. She recognized the writing immediately and let it fall to the table.
You're not going to read it?
It'll just be about me coming back, plans and such like.
You read it. It's fine.
While he cleared the plates, she opened the envelope, feeling his eyes on her. She scanned it swiftly and shoved it back inside.
What?
She looked up.
Why'd you wince like that?
She sighed.
Just my mother's manner of talking.
He walked back around the table and sat down, taking the letter from the envelope.
Don't.
He pushed her hand away.
Let me.
She turned away as he read it, frowning.
What's this? We will endeavor to forget your latest efforts to embarrass our family? What is that supposed to mean?
It's just how she is.
Did you tell them Van Cleve beat you?
No.
She rubbed at her face.
They would probably have assumed it was my own fault.
How could it be your fault? A grown man and a bunch of dolls. Jeez, never heard anything like it.
It wasn't just the dolls.
Fred looked up.
He thought I had tried to corrupt his son.
He thought, what?
She was already regretting having spoken.
Come on, Alice. We can tell each other anything.
I can't.
She felt her cheeks color. I can't tell you. She took another sip, feeling his gaze rest on her, as if to work something out. Oh, what was the point of hiding it? After today, she would never see him again. Finally, she blurted out,
I brought home a book that Marjorie gave me, about married love.
Fred clenched his jaw a little, as if he didn't want to think about Alice and Bennett and any kind of intimacy. It took a moment before he spoke.
What would he have to mind about that?
They both thought I shouldn't be reading it.
Well, maybe he felt that as you were in your honeymoon period, you—
But that's the thing. There was no honeymoon period. I wanted to see if—
If?
To see—
She swallowed.
If we had—
You had what?
Done it,
she whispered.
To see if you had done what?
She threw her hands up to her face and wailed,
Ugh, why are you making me say this?
Just trying to understand the facts of it, Alice.
If we had done it, married love.
Fred put down his glass. A long, painful moment passed before he spoke.
You don't know?
No,
she said miserably.
Whoa, hold on. You don't know if you and Bennett consummated your marriage?
No, and he wouldn't talk about it. So I have no way of knowing, and the book told me some things, but to be honest, I still couldn't be sure. There was a lot of stuff about wafting and rapture, and then it all blew up anyway, and it's not as if we ever discussed it, so I'm still not sure.
Fred ran his hand over the back of his head.
Well, Alice, I mean, it's, pretty hard to miss.
What is?
Oh, forget it.
He leaned forward.
You really think you might not have?
She felt anguished, already regretting that this would be the last thing he remembered of her.
I don't think so. Oh, Lord, you think I'm ridiculous, don't you? I can't believe I'm telling you this. You must think...
Fred stood up from the table abruptly.
No, no, Alice, this is great news.
She stared at him.
What? This is wonderful.
He grabbed her hand, began to waltz her around the room.
Fred, what? What are you doing?
Get your coat. We're going to the library.
5 minutes later, they were in the little cabin, two oil lamps burning as Fred scanned the shelves. He quickly found what he was looking for and asked her to hold the lamp while he flicked through the heavy, leather-bound book.
See?
He said, jabbing at the page.
If you haven't consummated your marriage, then you're not married in the eyes of God.
Meaning?
Meaning you can have the marriage annulled and marry who the hell you like, and there's nothing Van Cleve can do about it.
She stared at the book, read the words that his finger underlined. She looked up at him, disbelieving.
Really? It doesn't count.
Yes. Hang on, we'll find another of those legal books and double-check. That'll show you. Look, look, here it is. You're free to stay, Alice. See? You don't have to go anywhere. Look! Oh, that poor damn fool Bennett. I could kiss him.
Alice put down the book and looked at him steadily.
I'd rather you kissed me.
And so he did. 40 minutes later, they lay on the floor of the library on Fred's jacket, both of them breathing hard and a little in shock at what had just transpired. He turned to her, his eyes searching her face, then took her hand and raised it to his lips.
Fred?
Sweetheart?
Alice smiled, the slowest, sweetest smile, and when she spoke, it was as if her voice dripped honey and was shot through with happiness.
I have definitely never done that.
Chapter 28. From the body of the loved one's simple, sweetly colored flesh, which our animal instincts urge us to desire, there springs not only the wonder of a new bodily life, but also the enlargement of the horizon of human sympathy and the glow of spiritual understanding which one could never have attained alone. Dr. Marie Stopes, Married Love. Sven and Marjorie were married in late October on a clear, crisp day where the mists had lifted from the hollers by dawn and the birds sang loudly about the importance of a blue sky and squabbled noisily on branches. Marjorie had told him she would agree under sufferance because she didn't want Sophia yammering on at her till the end of time, and only if they told nobody and Sven didn't make a thing of it. Sven, who was agreeable in almost all things where Marjorie was concerned, greeted this invitation with a hard no.
If we marry, we do it in public, with the town, our child, and all our friends in attendance, he said, his arms folded. That's what I want, or we don't marry at all.
And so they were wed in the small Episcopalian church up at Salt Lick, whose minister was a little less picky than some about children born out of wedlock, and in attendance were all the librarians, Mr. and Mrs. Brady, Fred, and a fair number of the families they had brought books to. Afterward, they held a reception at Fred's house, and Mrs. Brady presented the couple with a wedding quilt that her quilting circle had embroidered, and a smaller one for Virginia's cot to match it. And Marjorie, despite looking somewhat awkward in her oyster-colored dress, borrowed from Alice, the seams let out by Sophia, wore an expression of embarrassed pride and managed not to change back into her breeches until the following day, even though it clearly pained her. They ate food brought by neighbors. Marjorie hadn't intended so many people to come and had been a little taken aback by the endless stream of guests. Someone started up a hog roast outside, and Sven wore a look of intense happiness, showing off Virginia to everyone, and there was fiddling and some fine dancing. At 6, just as dusk was falling, it was Alice who left the wedding party and finally located the bride, sitting alone on the path to the library steps, gazing up at the darkening mountain.
"Are you all right?" Alice said, sitting down beside her.
Marjorie didn't turn her head. She stared up at the tips of the trees, sniffed loudly, then let her gaze slide sideways toward Alice.
"Feels kind of weird to be this happy," she said,
and it was the most unsettled Alice had ever seen her. Alice considered this, then nodded.
"I understand," she said, and gave her friend a nudge. "You'll get used to it."
2 months later, after the Gustafsons had acquired a dog, a wall-eyed runt of a puppy, unwanted, some way from the quality hound Sven had suggested, he was, of course, crazy about it, Marjorie went back to work at the library. Virginia was minded 4 days a week by Verna McCullough, along with her own baby, a rather frail, freckled child by the name of Peter. Sven and Fred, aided by Jim Horner and a couple of the others, raised a small cabin a short walk from Marjorie's, with 2 separate rooms, a chimney, and a working WC outside, and the McCullough sisters moved into it willingly. They returned to their old home only to bring back a jute bag of clothing, 2 pans, and the mean dog.
"The rest of it stunk of our daddy," Verna said, and never spoke of it again.
Verna had begun to make the walk down into town once a week, mostly just to buy provisions with her wages, but also to have a look around, and people generally tipped their hat or left her alone, and her presence swiftly became unremarkable. Nita, her sister, was still not much inclined to leave the house, but they both doted on the babies and seemed to enjoy a little socializing, and over time, passers-by, who were not many in number, would remark that the dilapidated cabin up on Arnott's Ridge had begun to collapse, roof shingles first, then the chimney, and then, as the high wind caught the loose weatherboarding, the house itself, broken window by broken window, until it was half reclaimed by nature, shoots and brambles clawing it back to the earth, as they had so nearly done with its owner. Frederick Geisler and Alice were married a month after Marjorie and Sven, and if anybody noticed how much time they seemed to spend alone in Fred's house before they were legally tied, nobody seemed much inclined to comment on it. Alice's first marriage had been annulled quietly and with little fuss once Fred had explained the bones of it to Mr. Van Cleve, who, for once, did not seem to feel the need to shout, but engaged a lawyer who was able to facilitate such things swiftly and with perhaps a little greasing of the wheels to ensure confidentiality. The prospect of his son's name being associated publicly with the word annulment seemed to stay his habitual temper, and after that meeting, he barely mentioned the library publicly again. Under the agreement, they let Bennett marry again first. The librarians felt they owed the younger Van Cleve for the help he had given them, and Izzy even attended the day with her parents and said it was lovely, all things considered, and that Peggy made a beautiful and very contented bride. Alice barely noticed. She was so ridiculously happy that most days she didn't know how to contain it. Every morning before dawn, she would unwrap her long limbs reluctantly from those of her husband, drink the coffee he insisted on making for her, then walk down to open the library and get the stove going, ready for the others to arrive. Despite the cold and the brutal hour, she was almost always to be found smiling. If Peggy Van Cleve's friends chose to remark that Alice Geisler had let herself go something awful since she started up at that library, what with her unset hair and her mannish outfits, and to think her so refined and well-dressed when she came and all, then Fred couldn't have noticed less. He was married to the most beautiful woman in the world, and every night, after they had each finished work and put away the dishes side by side,
he made sure to pay homage. In the still air of Split Creek, it was not unusual for those who were walking past in the darkness to shake an amused head at the breathless and joyous sounds emanating from the house behind the library. In Baileyville, in winter, there was not much to do after the sun went down after all. Sophia and William moved back to Louisville. She did not want to leave the library, she told the other women, but she had been offered a job back at the Louisville Free Public Library, colored branch, and given their cabin hadn't been the same since the floods and William's chances of work were limited, they figured they would do better in the city, especially a city where there were large populations of people like themselves, professional people. Izzy cried, and the others didn't feel much better about it, but there was no arguing with good sense, and not much arguing with Sophia. Some time later, when they started to receive the letters she forwarded from the city and the photograph of her promotion, they framed it and put it up on the wall, next to the one of them all together, and felt a little better about it. Though it had to be said, the shelves were never quite as well organized again. Kathleen, true to her word, did not remarry, although there was no shortage of men who stopped by asking to court her once a decent amount of time had passed. She had no time for all that, she told the other librarians, what with the washing and the cleaning and looking after her children on top of her work. Besides, there was not a man who could measure up to Garrett Bly in the whole state. Though she would admit, when pushed, that she had been a little taken aback at how Jim Horner had scrubbed up at Alice's wedding, having received the attention of a professional barber and put on his good suit. His face was quite pleasing, liberated from all that hair, and his general appearance was much improved out of his dirty overalls. She would not marry again, oh no, she was adamant, but within a few months it was not unusual for the two of them to be seen taking a stroll around the town with their children and maybe attending a local fair together in the spring. It was good for his girls to have a feminine influence after all, and if there were some sly looks and raised eyebrows, well, that was their business. And Beth could stop looking at her like that, thank you very much. Beth's life remained largely unchanged immediately following the trial. She remained at home with her father and brothers, complained bitterly about them at every turn, smoked in private, drank in public, then surprised everybody 6 months later by announcing that she had saved every penny she had ever earned and was about to leave on an ocean liner to see the continent of India. They laughed at this at first. Beth was possessed, after all, of the strangest sense of humor. But she pulled the ticket from her saddlebag to show them.
"How on earth did you raise all that money?" said Izzy, confused. "You told me your daddy took half of it toward running the house."
Beth grew uncharacteristically tongue-tied and stammered out some response to do with extra work and savings that were her own, and not knowing why everyone in this darn town needed to know each other's business anyway. And when, a month after she had departed, the sheriff uncovered an abandoned still over by Johnson's fallen-down cow barn, the ground around it littered with cigarette butts, it was decreed that the two things could not possibly be related. Or at least, that was how they put it to her father. Her first letter came from a place called Surratt, and had the fanciest postmark you ever saw, and contained a picture of her wearing a brightly colored embroidered robe called a sari and holding a peacock under her arm. Kathleen exclaimed that it wouldn't shock her a whit if Beth ended up marrying the King of India, because that girl was plumb full of surprises. To which Marjorie responded dryly that that would certainly surprise them all. Izzy cut a record, with her father's permission. Within 2 years, she had become one of Kentucky's most popular singers, known for the purity of her voice and her penchant for performing in floor-length flowing dresses. She recorded a song about a murder in the hills that was popular across 3 states and performed an onstage duet with Tex LaFayette at a music hall in Knoxville that left her quite overcome for the best part of a week afterward, not least because he held her hand during the high notes. Mrs. Brady said that when it reached number 4 in the gramophone charts, it was the proudest moment in her life. Second only, she admitted privately, to the letter she had received from Mrs. Lena C. Nofsier some 2 months after the close of the trial, thanking her for her extraordinary efforts in keeping the WPA Packhorse Library, Baileyville, running in a time of crisis. "We women face many unexpected challenges when we choose to step outside what are considered our habitual boundaries, and you, dear Mrs. Brady, have proven yourself more than a match to any such challenge that has arisen. I look forward to discussing this and many other pertinent issues in person with you one day." Mrs. Nofsier had not yet made it as far as Baileyville, but Mrs. Brady was pretty sure it was going to happen. The library opened 5 days a week, its management split between Alice and Marjorie. And during that time, the women continued to lend every possible kind of novel, manual, recipe book, and magazine. Memories of the trial faded quickly, especially among those who realized they might like to continue to borrow books after all, and life in Baileyville returned to its normal rhythms. Only the Van Cleve men seemed at pains to avoid the library, driving their cars at speed up and down Split Creek, and mostly taking a route some way around town to avoid that building altogether. So when, several months into 1939, Peggy Van Cleve stopped by, it came as something of a surprise. Marjorie watched her spend some moments loitering outside, as if searching for something vitally important in her purse, then peering through the window to check if Marjorie was on her own. She wasn't known to be the most voracious of readers, after all. Marjorie O'Hare was a busy woman, what with Virginia, the dog, and her husband, and all the many distractions her home seemed to hold these days. But that evening, she would break off what she was doing and smile to herself, wondering whether to tell Alice Geisler how the new Mrs. Van Cleve had stepped inside, lowered her voice, and after some prevarication and a lot of theatrical scanning of random titles on the shelves, asked whether there was truth in the rumor that there was a book here that advised ladies regarding certain sensitive matters relating to the bedroom. Or how Marjorie had kept a straight face and said, "Why, yes, of course." It was just the facts, after all. She would still be thinking about it, and still trying not to smile, when they all arrived back at the library the following day. Postscript. The WPA's Packhorse Librarians of Kentucky program ran from 1935 to 1943. At its height, it brought books to more than 100,000 rural inhabitants. No program like it has ever been set up since. Eastern Kentucky remains one of the poorest and most beautiful places in the United States. We hope you have enjoyed this Penguin audio edition of Giver of Stars by JoJo Moyes, read by Julia Whalen. For more Penguin audio editions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Copyright in recording, Penguin Random House, LLC, 2019. Text copyright, JoJo Moyes, 2019. All rights reserved. The moral rights of the author have been asserted. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.